Let's please welcome Tony Gosling.
Okay, thanks very much. Is that sound all right? How's that going? Can everyone hear okay? Yep. Well, thanks everybody for coming, and thanks James for inviting me up to do another talk here. I'll just start because the reason I wanted to look at education and history is because I'm very annoyed and frustrated by the way that I was taught history, and I had an amazing lesson in British history, funnily enough, on the ferry across from Holyhead to Dublin once, this is about 5-6 years ago, from a farmer who taught me so much more actually about British history, and I was actually felt really annoyed sitting listening to this farmer that why was it that I had to learn about British-Irish history from somebody on a ferry, and why wasn't I taught it in school? And one example of why this is comes from John Dewey, who's a US philosopher, I suppose philosopher, writer. And his quote, as many of you may have heard before, is that education is a system of imposed ignorance. Now, why is that? Why should we give up our children to an education system willingly for them to then for the teachers to then teach them stuff which is not necessarily what we would ourselves teach our children? Of course, there is a burgeoning movement in Britain of home education with people like Education Otherwise who've decided that actually the school environment, the state school or the private school environment, is no good for their children. And I think one of the reasons for this is that education has changed tremendously since the late 1800s when we first started giving up our children to schools to be educated. The only way that people could be persuaded to give up their young ones to have most of the knowledge imparted to them was because the system at the time was basically attached to the church. It was seen to be a moral Christian system, and people were quite happy, because most of them were Christians themselves in the 1800s, to say, well, yes, you can educate them in the ways of Jesus and these morals of the church, because we think that's actually the way we want our children to be brought up, as good moral people. But over the years, of course, particularly since the 1960s and 70s, that whole attitude has changed within our schools in this country. Particularly, it's now a secular education that children are getting, and we're even in the situation where things about our history to do with the monasteries, this kind of thing, is not considered to be important. In fact, to push a moral education in this Christian way, which was the tradition, is now seen by many schools as being actually totally wrong, and parents can write letters of complaint about this kind of education. So you can see what's happened is we've been conned into giving up our children originally, not necessarily conned, but we've done that willingly. But then the system that we've given those children up to over 100 years or so has been completely changed. So we've got into that habit, but we haven't realised that things have changed because there's been so many different generations. I think it's also probably true to say that this is a similar thing that's happened with the empire. And I don't know how many of you read that. I did a little bit of research on the British Empire because we hear, oh, the British Empire was the biggest the world's ever seen. But how big was it? Well, okay, so it was Britain was the most powerful country in the world for over two centuries. At our peak in 1922, we were ruling over 500 million people, which was over a quarter of the world's population. So this was a massive empire. And my question I'm posing tonight really is, how come Britain is now being brought to its knees by the successors to the very people who built it up? And I would say partly that was to do with the way education has been denuded, and also, quite importantly, Freemasonry. Right. And we've all heard a little bit about Freemasonry over the weekend with this Anders Breivik in Norway being a Freemason. And I mean, it's not often that you actually get Freemasonry popping up on the news, but it has done. And also, from my own personal knowledge of former Freemasons, they have told me that because, you know, not all former Freemasons feel happy going to chat to journalists, because most journalists just raise their eyebrows at them. But I mean, I put quite a lot of information up on the internet about Freemasonry, and I have had former Masons come to me. And what they're telling me is that over the last 30, 40 years, there's been big, big changes in British Freemasonry, in that whereas in the old days it was seen as a kind of benevolent, again, Christian moral organisation, that lodges have become increasingly taken over the last 30, 40 years by ruthless people. So, for example, you may be a master of a lodge who's a very respected, good guy, who will, some excuse will be found to kick him out, and then someone else will take over the lodge. So the system of Freemasonry in Britain has been changing quietly, very, very quietly, behind the scenes over the last 30, 40 years. And I think, Freemasons would agree with me. Many of I've spoken to say, well, yes, the craft isn't what it used to be, and that's one of the reasons. But this is all happening in secret, of course, because this is what Freemasonry is. So, I'll tell you a little bit about me. I started off in the aviation business, a family business, which is aircraft, to do with aircraft, over about 4 or 5 years. And then I started working for the BBC in London in a newsroom, very busy newsroom in Marylebone High Street, which was the radio newsroom for the local station in London. We had a big audience. We had lots of big stories. That was in the early 90s. Then I went and started working with a campaign group and a guy called George Monbiot, who I've since really parted company with to a large extent. And that was a group called The Land Is Ours. And we were land rights campaigners, really going back to the fundamental problem, or one of the two, land and money, fundamental problems we're going to be looking at tonight. And that's land ownership. Because the land, the earth, is a free gift to mankind. You don't have to believe in God or otherwise. Everyone can see that, and yet slowly but surely over the centuries it's been being taken and taken and taken, and so more and more of us are now having to pay money to landlords just for somewhere to live. And if we don't, what happens? We get evicted. We're living in fear. This is supposed to be at one of our rights under the Universal Declaration of Human Rights after the Second World War in 1946-47 when it was signed, a right to shelter. But we don't actually have a right to shelter. If you'll find, if you try and get a house on the housing list here in with the local authority, you'll find just how difficult it is and how long you have to wait. But this is a fundamental right that everybody needs somewhere to live. And yet over the years, slowly but surely, bit by bit, we've been robbed of the land. And I'll talk about that a bit in my talk a bit later on. That's why we were in the mid-90s and sort of mid to late 1990s occupying bits of land in Britain to show how badly it was being used. For example, we occupied a site in Wandsworth in London, which was going to be used as a supermarket for 6 months, built a kind of eco-village there, and actually successfully stopped the supermarket. What we were doing as a group was coming on the back of small local campaigns, and then literally we had 3 or 4 coachloads of people going on a mystery tour, and then they all met up at the site and we took over the land for 6 months, the Guinness site. And the point was very well made, and a lot of people came down to our site to talk about the issue. Because they're saying, thank God someone's doing something about this. Even the local police were telling us what a criminal shame it was that this piece of land had been left derelict for such a long time. And of course, when someone is very wealthy in terms of land, okay, some landowners are very good, the big landowners, particularly they've got estate managers, etc. But very often now, land is just being used as an investment, an alternative to the stock market, particularly looking rather shaky right now. So when people are investing in land, what they're doing is they're just using it as a bit of money in the bank, and yet people need it to live on. And we've got to actually turn this whole thing around as part of the future. We've got to do that. There's no choice, I don't think. We've got to re-liberate the land one way or another. The other big problem, of course, is money, and the money system is a similar. I mean, basically, once you've been robbed of your land, then you have to buy into the money system in order to survive. You have to have money in order to buy food if you can't grow it yourself. And you have to have money to pay rent if you haven't got anywhere to live. So the two injustices, if you want, are totally bound up with each other. So then people may have seen me possibly on the BBC Conspiracy Files programme, which was about the 7/7 London bombings, because I'm also, very concerned about the whole war on terror and the way that's going in this kind of weird Orwellian style. And a lot of it seems to rely on media lies, mainstream media lies, and basically conning mainstream media through things like experts. Now, has anyone here ever heard of a website or an organisation called Spinwatch? If you have, look at that. Oh, no, nobody. Spinwatch is one of the most fascinating websites you'll ever go on, because you'll find there, if you see someone pop up on the TV or hear them on the radio as an expert, you can put them into the Spinwatch website. They're based up at Strathclyde University in Glasgow. And that will tell you who those people work for and who they have been sponsored by. So when they're an expert, I would actually say 9 times out of 10, An expert that pops up on the TV is an expert who is sponsored by some kind of organisation, whether it's a multinational corporation or whatever, or maybe an institute, a foundation-based institute. So a lot of what we're getting is actually just public relations going straight through the mainstream media, straight to us, and there's actually no real, honest journalism involved. It's just, what's the easiest thing for us to do? Oh, these guys are knocking on our door, they want to come on the telly and talk about this. And so often you hear the word Chatham House. How many people here have heard that on the television? Chatham House, which is the Royal Institute for International Affairs. We were told to use it when I was a journalist in London. Oh, phone up Chatham House. Well, who are these people? Why should we phone them up? Well, it turns out that they're part of these old round table groups which were set up about 70, 80 years ago. And it's basically a private club that lobbies for foreign policy. So, of course, all the big multinationals in Britain and other parts of the world as well, actually, fund Chatham House so that Britain's foreign policy reflects what big business wants. Now, the Foreign Office have another agenda, and Chatham House have their agenda, but you see, the Foreign Office is actually quite small, this democratic institution, compared to this enormous Chatham House, who dominate it through private interests. And you will see a lot of Chatham House people as spokespeople out there. So you may have seen me on the BBC Conspiracy Files on 7/7, which I did a talk about, I think it was about 18 months ago here, which certainly, in my opinion, is a very questionable event and potentially a false flag terrorist event designed to galvanise British public opinion and politicians behind further wars against Muslim countries for oil in the Middle East and Central Asia, these kind of places. And then I've gotten into doing community radio because I can be my own editor, my own boss if you want. When you're working for a big organisation like the BBC, you can't do this stuff because they'll kick you out. It's like career suicide. But what I can do is, through community radio in Bristol, and if anyone's interested, we do a programme every Friday evening between 5 and 7 o'clock live. If you're on the internet, you can hear it up here if you can be bothered. And I'll talk about that at the end as well. And I've been doing some work for the Russia Today channel, which some of you may have seen, which is a satellite and Freeview channel in the English language. I've also got a little website called Culture Shop. Now that cultureshop.org sells old documentaries. Now we're talking about things like the documentary about the Battle of the Beanfield, where all the Mrs. Thatcher organised for all of the travellers to be sent into a field and then literally smashed to pieces and beaten up by the police. We sell a documentary called The Battle of Trafalgar, which was all about the poll tax riots and takes literally a timeline through the day of the poll tax riots, so you can see exactly how the police got that riot going. There's all sorts of stuff on there, particularly stuff to do with the travellers. There's another one called Operation Solstice. There's various documentaries. But the idea being, if there's an important political documentary that pops up late night at one night on Channel 4, that it's not gone forever, that people can actually get copies. There's another one we sell called The Coconut Revolution, which is all about an island in the Pacific where there were actually a whole bunch of people there that got isolated and surrounded by a military blockade. Rather than give up, what they did is they actually created their own entire eco-energy system using coconut oil. They were driving vehicles around, generating power, and they had an entire power grid system based on eco-energy. That is to say, through coconut oil powering things and also through wind and water energy. And they fought back and actually ultimately won against the Indonesian government, who were trying to blockade their island. So this is the kind of thing that I do. Now, history, let's go back to start at around about 1500 BC, because this is where I think one of the most important concepts that we're desperately in need of today, every time you see on the news, and that's the thing called the Jubilee. Now, the Jubilee was all about debt forgiveness, right? Not paying your debts, which of course is what countries like Greece, Ireland, Italy, Portugal, Spain, and possibly us too, need to be considering right now, is because we're in something called a debt spiral of debt. That means that the debt can never be paid off, never. And it's getting bigger and bigger debt, more and more interest, and there's no way you're ever going to pay it off. So what you have to do is have a jubilee. And the Bible talks about this in Leviticus 25, where it basically says is, every 50 years, forgive all debts and start again. Very simple. Very, very simple. And also, the thing with Leviticus, it was also to do with land. So that's very important. So if you bought some land off a neighbour, you only bought it for the 50 years. After 50 years, you had to give it back again. So there was no way that you could actually become completely poor with no land and no ability to make a living. And wouldn't that be amazing today if everybody in the country had a little bit of space that they could build a workshop if they wanted to do something and they didn't have to pay somebody else just to be there. We have some squatters in Bristol, and one of them was talking to me the other day about being evicted, and he said, well, we can't leave the planet. Yeah? And you can't, can you? If you're going to be evicted from a place, you're just going to go and find somewhere else. And this is almost an expectation on the bailiffs when they evict somebody, is that, can you just please leave the planet? Where are you going to go? We've got to get this sorted out. And we will, I think, ultimately. Coming a little bit closer to today, to 30 AD or so, this was quite a big occasion of, and it won't be all about the Bible, don't worry, Jesus throwing the money changers out of the temple. The goldsmiths had monopolised the supply of money, something called the half shekel of the sanctuary, which was a coin which was used, which Bill still talks about in his documentaries, The Secret of Oz, which is all about the history of money, and also the Money Masters, which he made before that. And the worshippers needed to pay a temple tax in Jerusalem, this half shekel of the sanctuary, but the money changers had got a monopoly on it. So they started upping the price so they could get more and more and more, because they knew that people had to come and get this little half shekel. And that was the reason that Jesus got so annoyed about it, because he's saying, look, you're just taking the mickey, yeah? These monopolists are taking the mickey, just as our electricity power companies are now. Have you seen today that all this stuff about confusion marketing in the electricity industry? What they do is they deliberately come to us and they give us an impossible task to understand the various choices that there are. And they love that, because our heads are all tied up with some kind of trying to make some kind of decision. How do you compare one tariff with another tariff which is actually organised completely differently? You can't. So they are taking the mickey too. In fact, almost all of our privatised utilities are taking the mickey. The reason we nationalised these things after the Second World War was because we knew that there are basic things in society, if we want economic growth, that we have to produce at cost. Yeah? We produce electricity at cost for industry and for people in their homes. We produce water at cost for people in industry and in their homes. And these are all the basic essentials you need to build a strong economy. We make sure, that's the reason why these things were nationalised, because there was no choice after World War II. It had to work. And there was no chance of somebody in there, an individual, a friend of Mrs. Thatcher or whoever, taking from the system. So that was 30 AD. A little bit further, a little bit later on, of course, the Romans came over in 43 and invaded Britain. There was a resistance by a spirited bunch from East Anglia and from North Wales. But this was the introduction of money. And it's easy to forget that before the Roman invasion, we in this country, well, it wasn't us, it was probably, some other race and the Celtic races. But we didn't actually use money. We didn't need it. Because what mattered was things like stores of food and also honesty and loyalty to each other. These were the things that mattered. Money was a sort of an extra that we didn't really need, and you might exchange gifts, but we certainly didn't have any kind of fixed system of money before that. It's a little bit like thinking about the police. How long ago did the police first appear? When did we first decide we needed police? Well, okay, so they used to use soldiers to put down riots hundreds of years ago. But there wasn't thought to be necessary to have a police force up until the last 150 years or so. Okay, going a little bit further in time, following this thread, really, of money and land, to 1086. Now, does anyone know what happened in 1086? Doomsday. The Doomsday Book. Fantastic. The Doomsday Book. Very important. This was an inventory of all the resources in the country, so that the Normans could tax effectively, right? This is why William the Conqueror had the Doomsday Book drawn up. It's because he wanted to tax us all absolutely fairly, but to the max. And the reason it was called the Doomsday Book is because if that tax was written in the book, you had to pay it. There wasn't any choice. There was never going to be a choice for you. You've got to pay that tax. And if you didn't, you went to jail. And this was seen as a kind of, who does the king think he is that he has this amount of power over us? If we don't give him however many sheep, we're going to go to jail? And actually there were riots around Britain as William's men went round to try and find out how much of everything there was, how many fields, how many sheep, how many mills. His commissioners were set on by ordinary English people around the country in many parts of Britain, which many people don't realise. People didn't want this. Yet they saw that their loyalty and their freedom was being impinged on by William and his taxation system. So, okay, moving forward a little bit more. The resistance to the Norman invasion was by Hereward the Wake. This is in Ely, in East Anglia, in 1017-1071. And this was because there was a great deal of resentment amongst the Saxon population about these Normans coming in and taking everything over. Because what they did essentially is, okay, they won the Battle of Hastings, but what they did is they just put Norman chiefs in charge of everything, whether it was monasteries, churches, the church, land. And there was an immense resentment about these foreigners. Actually, the Normans, of course, were originally Vikings. They'd come down to Normandy from Scandinavia, settled in Normandy, and then decided, oh, look, we can go and take over Britain. And that's what they did. So Hereward the Wake was actually quite devious chap, very good at what he did, which was to harry the Normans horrendously. And he ended up actually flooding all the land around Ely, and the Normans couldn't get to Ely, so they had to build a bridge. They're slowly building a bridge further and further and further. And eventually, by the time they got to Ely, after having loads of them being shot by the Saxon arrows, Hereward was nowhere to be found. He disappeared off with his friends. So there was a lot of harrying of the Normans during the early days after the Norman invasion. Going forward another 50 years or so, this is 1118, and this is quite a big one. This is the formation of the Knights Templar, formed by Hugo de Payens. Now, this was the first multinational corporation in the world we'd ever had. And although maybe people didn't realise at the time, it was a big competitor to the Vatican, right? Because if you were a Knights Templar, you didn't have to abide by the laws of the country you were in. You had to abide by your own laws. And there was an expression in medieval times called drunk as a Templar, because these Templars could get as drunk as they wanted. And it was like they were a law unto themselves, a little bit like Judge Dredd. The other thing, of course, was that they went all the way around the Middle East slaughtering people in the name of Christ, which is a rather strange thing, you know, especially if we think about our friend Anders Breivik at the weekend. This is the Norwegian guy who was also, so we're told, a Knights Templar Freemason. So this is not something that's gone away. It's still with us. The interesting thing, of course, is that the headquarters of the Templars in Britain is just next to Fleet Street. So that was rather handy for manipulation of the press. If you think about it, you've got the main temple in London right next to Fleet Street, if you think about the geography of it. In Bristol, we have Bristol Temple Meads, which is where the temple was there. And so the Templars were based in Jerusalem, but they were the first multinational corporation, the first bank where you could pay your money in London, go trotting off across the world, and then take it out in Jerusalem. And they had obviously a lot of big institutions around the world, like the Catholic Church and the Vatican, were looking at the Templars saying, hang on a minute, guys, you're like our competition. Then in 1235, we got the Statute of Merton, which was the very first enclosure. So does anyone know what enclosures are? That's right. It was the first ever privatisation of land in Britain, actually, which was where there's common land, where people have common resources. That is to say, for example, they're allowed to graze their sheep, etc. Or they can go and pick wood to put on their fire. The Statute of Merton under Henry III was actually the first enclosure, and there was a big controversy about it at the time. Surely even the king shouldn't be allowed to do this. This is for everybody, this land. Everyone needs it. But they allowed it through. And of course, at the time, everyone who was involved in the judicial system and with the king, they were all landowners already. So they're basically voting themselves a bit more land. But it set a precedent, and slowly over hundreds and hundreds of years, there was more of this land privatisation. Because essentially, that's what enclosure is, privatisation of land. Something which was seen as something which you could never have as your personal possession, because everybody needs it, is suddenly privatised. A little bit like Mrs Thatcher and, I don't know, BT. But this is with something very fundamental. If you think about it, land is something very different to most of the things we own. Like this book here, for example. You know, this is, I can move it around. Yeah, you can't really do that with land. And also, it's something you can make. You can't make land. So there was something very strange about that. Now, if we compare it to today, it's a bit like genetic ownership of genetic material. Most of us would think you can't own somebody's genes, but of course that's what a lot of corporations now do. They do own individual genes for plants, for species, various things. So in those days, it was a similar kind of thing. It was a whole new idea that you could privately own land. That beforehand, all the land had been basically owned by God through the king and through the feudal system. So the king and the barons all owned the land, but ultimately it was God's land and they were just looking after it for God. When they started privatising, this was a whole new way of dealing with land. Okay, so 1312, we were rolling on the years. The Templars were dissolved by Philip the Fair of France. And the Grand Master of the Templars, Jacques de Molay, was executed. Because over the couple of hundred years since they started, the Knights Templar had become extremely powerful. They were the strong men of Europe, basically the big boys. And also they generally looked after all of the feudal system, the gentry, the knights, the kings and all that. The Templars would look after their money for them. And there was an incident in France with Philip the Fair, where he had a foreign dignitary staying with him, and they were talking in the evening about some amulet of some kind, a crown or something, some jewel, that this guy from abroad was talking to Philip the Fair about. And he says, oh, I've got that in my treasury. And so they raced off to the treasury in the evening, and the Templars said, oh, sorry, but I can't let you in. Now, this was very annoying for Philip the Fair of France, right? He's the king. I'm the king. Let me in to see my stuff. Oh, no, I can't let you in. It's more than my job's worth, sir. And this annoyed Philip, and he was saying, well, hang on, who is actually in charge? These guys are getting a bit arrogant. So he had them investigated, and he found that the Templars were doing all sorts of naughty things and certainly weren't doing Christian things, like worshipping ebony skulls. Well, they weren't actually skulls, but they were carved out of ebony. And they were doing things like spitting on the cross. And certainly it was a very anti-Christian thing, posing as a Christian thing, which is why I draw the comparison with what we had in Norway recently, where you've got a guy calling himself a Christian and yet going around murdering people for no reason, at least not for any reason that anyone of us would see would be a just reason. So that was the dissolving of the Templars by Philip the Fair of France. And many would say that the French Revolution was very bloody years afterwards because of a long-held resentment by the Templars against the French aristocracy. This is one of the reasons why we had everybody, really, in France who they could get their hands on by the revolutionaries was guillotined to destroy the bloodlines of Philip the Fair. That's speculation, but there are sources that will tell us that. Okay, 1348, the Order of the Garter was formed. That's here in Britain. Now, many would say that this was only a few years after the end of the Templars. But I think what happened was, in Britain, is the Templars realised that we can't be Templars anymore because we've been discredited through all these revelations about spitting on the cross. You know, we can't really get away with it anymore. And the Order of the Garter is still very, very powerful today. It's 26 knights, which, if you think about the numbers, is two covens. And these knights are there supposedly to protect the Queen. Now, I would say that they're almost like mafia enforcers around the Queen. The Order of the Garter. And they've taken on the mantle of the Templars that the Templars used to do. So they're occultic, and always the Prince of Wales is one of these Knights of the Garter. If you just have a look at them, the pictures of the Garter Knights, you'll find, well, who are these old fogies? Anyway, they are supposed to be looking after the monarchy, but I would say that they're steering the monarchy in totally the wrong direction, which is one of the reasons that the monarchy is so unpopular. Okay, maybe with William and Kate, maybe they'll do something different, but certainly up till now, certainly with Prince Charles, has made a real mess of things. Of course, he's still sitting there waiting in the wings for longer than any other heir apparent ever in history in Britain to become king. But no, very, very few people in Britain, all surveys show, actually want him to be king. They'd much rather it hopped over him and went to William or Harry or whoever. So they are there, I think, to control the monarchy. The monarchy is actually very powerful still. It's the titular head, anyway, of the armed forces, the air force, the army and the Royal Navy, and also the judicial system. The Queen is still very powerful with things like Lord Lieutenants as well out in all of our counties. There's actually quite a good book by Jeremy Paxman about this whole network of power that the royals still have behind the scenes. 1381, the peasants revolt. Hooray! The peasants revolted because they'd had enough. Because they'd been starting to be kicked off the land, and also agricultural wages were going down, they decided to revolt against the king. And it was also to do with a poll tax of its time. The idea that every individual person had to pay a tax, a certain amount, regardless of their income. So, you know, someone who had a massive income had to pay the same tax as someone who had no income. Well, if you've got no income, how can you pay anything? So this is why the peasants were getting annoyed. And that was Wat Tyler and mostly Kentish people coming up to London and making demands. Well, what happened is the king agreed to the demands, and they all went off back home happy, and then, of course, he sent out his sheriffs and arrested them and hanged them. So it was just a complete con by the king. That was 1381. We're going on a couple of hundred years. 1535 between 1535 to 1540, a big change happened in Britain, which was the dissolution of the monasteries. This was Henry VIII, who, as we all know, didn't get on so well with the Catholic Church and the Vatican and decided actually he was going to make the rules. And also decided he was going to put down the church at the same time. It affected 900 monastic communities around the country over those 5 years or so. It must have been devastating for them, you know, that what they're doing and making wine and things, and all of a sudden they're told, get out. And the number of, there's about 9,000 monks and nuns were involved. And the big change after the dissolution of the monasteries was that there was £90,000 a year extra for the king. So you can see what was going on there. He was just using and abusing his power simply to destroy the power of the church in the country. And the idea that, I mean, basically what we had before the dissolution was all these monasteries around the place that were doing a lot of public good. They were providing things like hospitals, infirmaries. They were actually producing food at very reasonable prices. In fact, sometimes for free. And they were centres of learning as well, because they were places where books were being copied, and they had their own libraries. I'm not saying that all the monasteries were great. I'm sure they weren't. There were a load of corrupt abbots and goodness knows what. But this was a major move against the church by the king of the day. £90,000 a year doesn't sound a lot now, of course, but in those days it would be billions extra for the king in taxes. We go forward a little bit more to 1549. 1549 was one of the biggest rebellions we ever had in Britain, and one of the most successful, even though it only lasted for 6 weeks. The whole of East Anglia was ruled from under an oak tree by a guy called Robert Kett. He was a landowner, and he had said for years, oh, this enclosure thing is terrible, we can't do it, we mustn't kick the peasants off the land because they've got nowhere to go, they're camping out by the hedgerows and the streets, we can't do this. And anyway, the local people discovered that he was actually enclosing his land, privatising the land around his estate, and putting up fences and ditches to seal it off so the local people couldn't use it anymore. So they all turned up outside Robert Kett's farm and said, what are you doing, Robert? What are you playing at? You said you'd never do this. And he said, well, I've got to, because all the other landowners around here are encroaching onto my, potentially what would be my land, so I need to grab it before they do. Anyway, he agreed to lead a rebellion because there were so many local people who were complaining. He led a rebellion of tens of thousands of people across East Anglia against the Enclosure Acts. And for 6 weeks, he ruled, as I said, from under an oak tree, which is still there, apparently, in a place called Wyndham, just south of Norwich. And what the first thing they did, you see, they're deciding how to run East Anglia from under a tree. The first thing they did was to find out all of the big local landowners who had been enclosing the land were. And they sent parties of peasants out to arrest these landowners. And they brought them to the tree and tried them for theft of the land. And those who were found guilty were sent to Norwich prison. And this was actually working very well, because the peasants were going around also tearing down the fences and filling in the ditches. And so it was starting to spread. Word was getting around the country, so the king had to act. And he sent an army about 5 weeks into the rebellion to try and put down these people. And the army was actually turned back by peasants with pitchforks. They may have had one or two guns from the Norwich City Armoury, I'm not sure, but they had to go back to London again. And so the king had to actually get all of his forces from right across the country in order to put the rebellion down. And so for 6 weeks we had a kind of, you know, interesting... Anyway, ultimately, Robert Kett was strung up in chains and left to die on the walls of Norwich by the king's army, who finally put down the rebellion. But this was actually quite an important piece of history, which certainly I was quite amazed to hear about. And back in 1999, with some friends from the Land Is Ours campaign I was talking about earlier, we went and squatted a derelict mental home in Norwich as a celebration of 450 years since Kett's Rebellion, it was back in 99. And we stayed in this derelict mental home, which had every single window smashed in it. We were basically just camping outside it for about 6 weeks, funnily enough. And we got a load of really positive coverage in the local press in Norwich. They thought, this is a really fascinating bit of our history. And it was also, I think, just trying to remind us that actually the land is not the landowners, the land is the people's. So that was 1549. 100 years or so later, there was something called the English Civil War, which was basically about land. Funnily enough, a lot of people would say, all sorts of academics would scratch their heads and say, oh gosh, what was that all about? Ship money and taxation and blah. No, it was about land. And the reason I can tell you that is because I did some research from some historians when I was living in Oxford into the taxes which Charles I imposed. Charles I, who was a king just before and during the English Civil War, he imposed taxes on any landowner who had enclosed land, because the Archbishop, Bishop Lord, came to him and said, look, we've got all these people just trying to live in hedgerows and, you know, they're being kicked off the land by these people. We can't carry on like this. And so the king decided, okay, I'm sure he was looking to make some money too out of the merchant classes who've been privatising land, but he put some rather big taxes on anybody who decided they wanted to enclose their land. So this was a massive, dissuaded people from doing it. And of course, many of them had had a look at the land and said, oh, this is worth this much. Crikey, I can, if I take all this over for myself, I can make even more money. And the big mistake that Charles I made was he made his taxes retrospective, right? So that was saying, anybody that enclosed when it was legal 3 years ago, I want some tax for that land you enclosed. Now, that was a mistake, I think, because it really was a kind of unlawful thing for him to do, and silly and greedy. Because it got the merchants really, got their backs up. They were saying, you can't change the law. When we did it, it was legal. Yeah? Imagine if, you know, you get arrested by a policeman and saying, you were doing, I've got you on a camera 3 weeks ago doing 30 miles an hour in this limit, which we've just today put up to 20. That was the kind of, and this is why I think there was a war in the English Civil War, is because Charles I made his taxes on enclosure retrospective, rather than just telling people, you do it from today, you're going to get taxed. The other thing was, if they didn't want to pay the tax, they could simply return the land back to its former common ownership, right, so that all the peasants were able to come back into their homes. Anyway, that's my own take on the Civil War, and do check it out if you want to. Anyway, people sometimes talk about it as a revolution. It wasn't, no way, a revolution. It was a civil war between two aristocratic style classes, the aristocracy, the feudal classes versus the merchant classes. So this is the landowning wealthy versus the financial wealthy in the Civil War. And who won? The merchant classes won. And these are the people that we're having to deal with today, the City of London and the financial oligarchy. They were the merchant classes who won in the English Civil War with Cromwell. After the Civil War, massively increased acceleration in enclosure. If you have a look at the figures, there were little bits of land around Britain being enclosed, little bit here, little bit there. After the Civil War, it massively accelerates. It becomes systematic. Anybody who's has even a small landholding, a small farmer, will be looking to take over and privatise the land all around them and kick those peasants off, giving them maybe a barrel of beer in compensation for the land which should be staying in their family for literally thousands of years in the future. I would say at this point, it's not completely gone. Laxton in Nottinghamshire, which is near Newark, is a town which has never been enclosed. It's owned by the Crown Estate, so if you're ever up near Newark, go and check out Laxton. It's got a little kind of barn with a whole museum thing inside it, and also it's still got open fields, because the open field system was what our original people that settled this country decided was the best way to do things. That was the open field system in medieval times and before that was usually two or three big fields which were shared amongst the whole community. And then everyone would have small patches as well of their own. But the most important thing was that the land passed on through the family. You couldn't hock your house against a bank loan, for example, because the bank could only allow it to pass to other people in your family. It couldn't put it on the open market. This is crucial. And the other thing is, with the fields, basically you would have usually three field system, with one field growing wheat, one field for bread, one field growing barley for beer, and the other field fallow. And that would be a crop rotation system. And that's what it used to be. There's only one part of Britain which still does this, and that is actually the crofts in the Highlands. If people have ever been up to the Highlands, the crofting acts were brought in order to enshrine in law the traditional landholding system. And you'll find that if somebody dies without having anyone to hand on their land to up in the crofts, or if somebody just simply moves out of the area, their house is not sold on the open market. The crofting committee gets together and decides who's going to have it for nothing. That may be, for example, someone who's a brother of someone who's also been on the croft and hasn't got any land. So they decide who gets the croft for free. Your croft comes with a little bit of land, which you can either use yourself, and this is present day. If you're ever up in Scotland, go and talk to these crofters. They're very independent-minded people, and they understand that they actually are the only people in Britain that still hold their land in this way. So you either use your land for yourself, maybe you want to grow some crops on it. Say, for instance, you're doing IT and you're a crofter. You're going off into the city and doing IT. You don't need to use your land. You can rent it out to your neighbour if you want to. The other thing is, you have the rights on all of the mountains around the area, right? So you can have sheep up on the mountains as well. So it's a very traditional form of land holding. And crofting museums and things like that, if you're ever up there, well worth a visit, and you'll find the people who live on the crofts are the most, they're like owner-occupier farmers. You know, they're very, very, very independent-minded people. The levellers and the diggers during the English Civil War, also very important movements. The levellers were against distinctions of class and wealth. Lieutenant Colonel John Lilburn, he was one of the leveller leaders. He was also one of Cromwell's trusted lieutenants. But he wanted to have actually one man, one vote. And even one woman, one vote. Even back in the Civil War they were pushing for this. But Cromwell was going to have none of it. So the levellers were a very important movement. There's a book by Brailsford, a green book by Brailsford, which goes through all of the fascinating changes that happened in this country in the English Civil War, which include things like the Anabaptists and the Quakers, who first arrived, because a lot of the struggles in the Civil War were to do with religious freedom. People wanted to just do what they wanted to do. They weren't going to be told what to do by the Church of England. And so there were a lot of things like the Methodists came later, but similar kinds of alternatives to the state religion. People wanted to do what they wanted to do. Yes, and Lilburn, ultimately, he was tried several times, but he survived the war and became a Quaker eventually. But they were a fascinating bunch. The Diggers under Gerard Winstanley famously said, "The earth is a common treasury for all." They went on some land in St George's Hill in Surrey, and they took it over, basically a bit of common land, and said, "Look, everybody needs some land, so let's just take a bit of land and do it." And they did for about 6 or 8 months. In fact, maybe a bit longer than that, several years. There is a film called Winstanley, made by Kevin Brownlow in the 60s, which is, you know, shows the whole story of what the Diggers did, their vision for the future, which was, the earth is a common treasury for all. It should be simple, shouldn't it? And that's what they were saying. He was a brilliant pamphleteer and a fantastic writer. Some people talk about the Diggers as the first communists. Well, it depends what kind of communists you're talking about, really, doesn't it? Not like Stalin, but a kind of more of an English-style fluffy communists. 1694, incorporation of the Bank of England, the Private Bank of England, for the first time. This is all happening, as you see. I was talking about enclosure and money. It all starts to accelerate after the English Civil War because the City of London is now running things. Whereas before it had been the feudal system, it had been the king, the barons, all these people, the landowners, no longer. And of course, the landowners were a little bit more tied to the people because they were in touch with common ordinary people much more than these bankers and the merchants were. They saw ordinary people just as a sort of labour unit or whatever to exploit. If we go forward a little bit in time. Oh, yes, sorry. With the Bank of England, a royal charter. I didn't realise this until I started looking it up. Bank of England was only allowed to last for 12 years from 1694. So with a little bit of maths, just into the 1700s, the Bank of England should have been closed down. But of course it wasn't, and it's still going to this day. As a private bank, I say private because no one is quite sure about who owns the shares in the Bank of England. We actually did this at the Bank of England Museum once, went and asked at the desk, who owns the shares in the Bank of England? Oh, well, you have to go and ask the Treasury. Well, you ask the Treasury, they say ask the bank. So this is another big, weird question. Who actually owns those shares? And the bank was created back all that time ago in 1694. Then we move on to 1759. This is another sort of, that's about 80-year jump. But to the Hellfire Club. Medman Abbey near High Wycombe was the home of something called the Hellfire Club. The monks of Medmenham, as they called themselves, had these satanic orgies under the ground. Francis Dashwood was in charge of this. I don't know if people have heard about the Hellfire. You can still go and visit High Wycombe, and you can still visit the caves where they used to be. The funny thing was, Francis Dashwood was Chancellor of the Exchequer at the time. And there he was cavorting underground and having these orgies. He was actually Chancellor from 1762 to 1763. As you see, he didn't last very long because he was bringing in cuts. Massive cuts, and he was incredibly unpopular. So eventually he was voted out. Does this maybe have some similarities with the Bullingdon Club that we see today with George Osborne, Nathaniel Rothschild, Boris Johnson, and various others? That club in, I'm not saying that they are doing the same kind of thing necessarily as the Hellfire Club, but it does seem that we've got these kind of cults. This is a sort of cult in the centre of our government in 1762 and 1763. Nowadays, I would argue that the Bullingdon Club and their influence from Oxford and Eton, places like that, is a small bunch of people who are all very, they know each other very well. They used to go around at Oxford drinking and smashing places up. George Osborne, who's our present Chancellor of the Exchequer, he used to have the chequebook. So when the Bullingdon Club, this present day thing, had their drunken session and they'd smashed a place up, George Osborne was the guy who'd come round the next day with a chequebook saying, OK, sorry about that last night, how much? He's also known amongst his Eton friends as the Oik. And there's a strong, well, I can't say this is an absolute fact, but certainly several places, if you have a look on the internet, you'll see references to it, that apparently David Cameron was boasting at Eton how he'd got George Osborne's trousers off and had him hanging upside down by his legs from some bars when they were at Eton. And that's why he was called the Oik, because he would, you know, he was the guy that the big guys, the bullies, kicked around. But he was still part of the club, and he wanted to constantly stay in the club. Yeah? So this is the kind of thing that's been transformed from this public school right into the centre of our government, the heart of our government right now. Quite worrying. So that was the Hellfire Club. 1776, the foundation of the Illuminati. Now that's Adam Weishaupt, that's a few years later. He was a professor of church law in Ingolstadt in Germany. Now many people think, oh, the Illuminati, well, look, there's one really good, in fact two, but one particular really good reference book on this, and that is The Proofs of a Conspiracy Against All the Religions and Governments of Europe by John Robison. Robison was the secretary of the Royal Society in Edinburgh. He was a close friend of James Watt, who invented the steam engine, and Robison was a Freemason. He saw the Illuminati acting within Freemasonry, and he was livid, hated what they were doing. And so he wrote an expose of these illuminated Freemasons. And, I mean, for many people now reading it, it all looks kind of amazing to see. But they have all these kind of initiation rites, which were supposed to be secret. Robison could speak fluent French and German, so he went and researched the Illuminati around Europe and translated it all into English for us. And in the 1970s, it was all reprinted in the United States. And when I first tried to get hold of this Proofs of a Conspiracy, it was almost impossible. It was £100 a copy for it. That was back in the 90s. But now you can just read it on the internet at a place called sacredtexts.com. Has this, plus another very good source material this is. From the late 1700s, people who knew what was going on with the formation of the Illuminati wanted to make sure that people like us in the future knew what they were up to. So there it is. It's called Proofs of a Conspiracy Against All the Religions and Governments of Europe. And this is what I would argue. I mean, I don't know if the Illuminati still exists today, but certainly something very similar to these aims is going on out there. It's a kind of mafia state of some sort, a covert secret government of some kind. And they certainly seem to be very interested in taking over our religions, our heart, and our governments, our head, maybe. Okay, moving on a little bit. There's another, before I finish, there's one more book as well called The Code of the Illuminés by Abbé Barruel. He also wrote at the end of the 18th century. That was 1798. So together, if anyone's really interested in finding out who these Illuminati are, what their aims were originally, because they're certainly a historical fact. You look them up in the Collins Dictionary. You'll find them in the Collins Dictionary. 1789, the French Revolution. As I referred to before, the Revenge of the Templars. Now, this was organised through something called Grand Orient Freemasonry in France. Grand Orient Freemasonry was very different to the English style of Freemasonry because it was an atheist Freemasonry. 1815, pretty much all of Britain had been enclosed. Right? Do you remember we went right back to the Statute of Merton, the very first enclosure? Bit by bit by bit by bit, it was enclosed. Just to give you an idea of what it was like in a village when someone was going to enclose your land, what would happen was someone would come from London, or a court officer, and put a notice on the parish church door to say this land's being enclosed. There are several examples, one in Oxfordshire, where even though this chap from the court had come at 6 o'clock in the morning, by the time he got to the parish church, the whole village was up. The whole village was between him and the door, so that he couldn't pin his notice up on the door and he'd have to go away and sneak back another day. Because people were quite aware that this was theft that was going on. It was their heritage and their future and their children's future, which was their land, which was being taken away from them through these enclosure acts. 1847, Irish potato famines. This is over in Ireland, of course. They were ruled with a rod of iron. But in 1879, something started called, and was actually in fairly full flow by then, called the Irish Land League. And I would argue one of the reasons that Ireland got its independence is because the Irish were well organised against the English landowners. They had something called the Land League and Michael Davitt. What they managed to do, very successfully through, I mean, if you imagine what we're in a situation now, aren't we, with a coalition government where Nick Clegg and the Liberal Democrats hold the balance of power and are doing absolutely, virtually nothing with that balance of power. Back in the late 1800s, it was nothing like that. Actually, what happened was the Irish MPs, because Ireland was still part of Britain, had the balance of power with the Whigs and the Tories. Right? They held the balance of power. So they said, we will only support one or the other if one of you does land reform in Ireland. And that's what they did. They actually had government loans for all these poor peasants right across southern Ireland to buy the land that they were renting and build their own house on it. And would you believe that the repayments on these loans were something like a quarter what the old rents had been? Right? So they didn't have to live in hovels anymore. They had a nice new house and they owned the land they were on, and it only cost a quarter of what it used to when they were paying money to the landlords. So that was a massively important piece of it. It's called the Windham Act. And it was a very important reason why Ireland is... Now, if you go over to Ireland, you'll find lots and lots of owner-occupier farmers, small farms. And most people, certainly in the rural areas, own their own land. That's the reason, is because they did, back in the late 1800s, what Nick Clegg and the Liberals should be doing now. That's using the fact that they've got the balance of power at Westminster. They can play one party off against the other and get what they want. Clegg is obviously not interested in that right now. 1880s was the Highland Clearances. And this is where I mentioned the crofters earlier on. Crofting, as I said, is probably the only type of landholding which is traditional medieval style, and the way that people originally, when they settled land, wanted things to be. What happened was a lot of evictions going on up in Scotland in the clearances, and there was one incident in 1888, the Battle of the Braes. In Skye, they heard that some people in Portree were being evicted because they'd refused, or they simply couldn't pay the rent. And anyway, the landowners sometimes used to just kick people off for no reason because they just wanted to put sheep on, and they could make more money from sheep than they could get in the rents. So they just kicked people off. And in fact, people were burnt alive in their own homes because this is the Highlands. It was miles away from anywhere. An old lady is a very good example of an old lady actually being burnt alive in her own home because no one even cared, because no one could see what was going on. And that was the sort of evictions that were happening to make way for sheep so that the landowners could get more money from the land. A lot of the times this was encouraged by the fact that these Scottish landowners had been down gambling in London and lost their money, so they needed to make more money out of the land. The Battle of the Braes changed all that, because on the way, while the police were off to the eviction in Skye, the whole of Skye set on them as they were on their way to the eviction across the hills. And it was all organised by the women of Skye, funnily enough. The men seemed to be a little bit like robotic and just do what we're told. But the women of Skye didn't. And they said, well, we're going to have these coppers. And they were lobbing rocks at them and everything and drove them off. Now, there was a big fuss about it, about the grievances of the crofters and the Times, before Rupert Murdoch bought it, obviously, had a big report about the crofters, and there was a royal commission set up into the grievances of the crofters, which is what brought about the crofting acts we have today. So many people don't realise that Scotland and the crofts hold quite a great deal of our history in trust for us. Just whizzing through more recently, we had World War I and World War II. One of the most important things about World War I is simply that it was a family squabble. A lot of the rulers of Europe were simply in the same family. Ridiculous war, horrendous war, obviously. If anyone's ever seen Oh, What a Lovely War, the film, it really captures the pointlessness, the total disgusting waste of it all. And the Second World War, one of the important things to know about that is that a lot of the money that Hitler used came through this thing called the Bank for International Settlements. And I was looking at the TV on, I think it was on Newsnight the other night, and they had on the bottom of the screen in small print figures from the Bank for International Settlements. Now, after World War II at the Bretton Woods Conference, they argued that this bank had to be abolished because it had funded Hitler. It had been set up after World War I in order to manage the reparations after World War I. And there it was, still lively and alive and kicking after the Second World War, having helped fund Hitler. The Bank for International Settlements is a kind of banker's bank based in Basel in Switzerland, a big headquarters, even though up until about 10, 12 years ago, it was in a former chocolate shop in a sort of anonymous place, so no one knew where it was. Then they built their big headquarters, and it's called the Tower of Basel, which you might just just think might be the Tower of Babel. But anyway, it's a hideous looking building, and I had a friend that took some photographs of it for me, and he was followed by the secret police in Switzerland for the rest of his holiday. He was quite nervous about it. But this is where a lot of the big decisions about money are made, at the Bank for International Settlements. Of course, there was also Prescott Bush during World War II, who was prosecuted for trading with the enemy. He was actually selling oil to the Nazis through Switzerland. This is George Bush's grandfather. And so, you know, we're starting to get into the present day and the abuse of money and the way that money is now managed by private organisations and essentially by an international secret government or mafia. And, you know, I have no great hopes for George Osborne's ability to actually deal with this mafia, especially when I think of him hanging upside down at Eton, having his bottom smacked by David Cameron. So that'll do for the first half. I'm just going to have a little, just for the part two, I'll just do a sort of round up for 10 minutes, and then I want to throw it open for questions so we have as much time as possible for questions. So see you after the break.
Thank you very much, Tony.
Just a couple of things which I think I probably should have included in the first bit, really. We're going to have another scope across history. But the first thing I would say is just to talk about a little bit about the tactics. When the Romans invaded Britain, there were several parts of the country they found it very difficult to put down and to get under the yoke. And those two, I mentioned East Anglia, which we had also another big rebellion, about 1,500 years later. But the Ordovice were a tribe in the north of Wales and around Anglesey. Of course, that was where the Druids were all based. So this was a kind of centre of learning for pre-Roman Britain. And the Romans, just like they did with Scotland, had a terrible time trying to put this tribe down and to take over that part of the country. And the reason was because, quite sensibly, the local tribes in North Wales had decided that they would give up their traditional tribal centre and that they would use the big advantage they had over the Romans, which was their local knowledge of the local area. And so, week by week, sometimes night by night, the tribe would move around the whole time. It had no base, and the Romans therefore couldn't actually ever destroy their centre, destroy their base, because they were constantly on the move. They had crops growing all over the place, and so they would move from one place to another, and one place to another. So this is one of the reasons why the Roman Empire has such a headache with North Wales, and of course, similarly with the clans in Scotland, they never actually managed to take over Scotland. I don't know what life must have been like for a Roman legionnaire standing in the cold on Hadrian's Wall and getting shot at and whatever, but you know, the Scottish and the North Welsh were very, very good at resisting the Roman invasion and very successful. The other thing to say, of course, the other big change that happened with the Romans and the introduction of money was with the Normans. We had the introduction of something far worse, what we're seeing the consequences of right now, which is the introduction of usury. That is the legalisation of the charging of interest. This is one of the things the Normans brought in under their sort of nominally Christian way of doing things. Actually, the three main monotheistic faiths, that is the Jews, the Muslims and the Christians, all outlaw usury, all outlaw the charging of interest as a basic fundamental law. In the Jewish tradition, what's happened is that it largely means that Jews will never charge interest to other Jews, but they will to non-Jews. In the Muslim world, all the banks, you're not allowed to have a bank in the Muslim world unless it doesn't charge interest. And one of the ways you get around this fact that the banks would never make any money otherwise, just lending out money and coming back again, is what's happened is an administration charge is made, a small administration charge, but it certainly can't accrue in the way it is accruing right now here in Britain and in other parts of, particularly in Europe, but other parts of the world. And this was seen to be a horribly evil thing in years gone by, but that was something which was given up in Britain with the Norman invasion. Very few people know that the Normans actually, one of the things that they did was allow people to then start charging interest. We had church courts back in those days. Someone could be arrested and jailed and fined, possibly even put to death. I'm not sure about that. But certainly you weren't allowed to charge interest up until the Normans invaded. A lot of the stuff that I'm talking about you will find in something which cost a cover price of about £3, and it's called the Wordsworth Dictionary of British History. It's a really simple book. You find it in second-hand shops, for example, on the internet for like 1p. But it's actually a really good history book and a dictionary of history, because lots of the official history books, the Cambridge, the Oxford, etc., miss out loads of this stuff. How many of them talk about the formation of the Illuminati? Virtually none. Even though in Britain there was a very powerful movement in the late 1700s to make sure that everybody knew who the Illuminati were and were aware of what they were up to. And most of the people who were doing that were themselves Freemasons. They could see how the craft that they loved was being perverted and destroyed by this new movement. The other important book was to do with the English Civil War, and that is a book called The World Turned Upside Down by Christopher Hill. And that explains some of the ideals that there were in the English Civil War. The Bible talks about that, Jesus turning the world upside down, making the people who are the first, last, and the last first, turning everything on its head, so putting the meek in charge, and actually taking these high and mighty rich types who are abusing power and putting them in their rightful place. So The World Turned Upside Down by Christopher Hill is also a really good... the English... Isn't it strange how we English, and this is, I would say, the key point I'm making in this talk, is how little we understand the English Civil War. This was a key event in world history. It's the only reason that Britain's empire, that we talked about right at the start, was so big. It's because the merchants were in control over the whole of Britain. That's why we had an industrial revolution here. It's because we kicked all these people off the land using enclosure, and we had a program to take over the world. Amazing, but true. And the Civil War was at the heart of this. Up until the English Civil War, really there'd only been city-states, places like Venice, being controlled by merchants, by the merchant class, by the banking class. And after the English Civil War, they took over England and they used it to take over, you know, vast parts of Africa, America, and all these other places. And, you know, Bristol was quite a big part of that in the sailing of John Cabot to discover, in the Matthew, to discover America. But this is a whole other story there, because many of these organisations, like the Merchant Adventurers, which sent people out to discover these foreign lands as part of the slow acquiring of territory that built up the empire, was kept secret. Many of the discoveries that they made were only known to a handful of people, and there was all sorts of deception involved in trying to con people into thinking that they discovered a new world out in this direction, and then say the Spanish would then send off their ships to another place and get wrecked or find nothing. So there was a whole load of disinformation, and I would compare that right to what's going on today with oil exploration, for example. These companies like BP, Shell, Exxon, who say they have oil in various parts of the world, or they talk about these amounts of reserves that they've got, this is information which is impossible to verify, impossible to verify. And yet there it is on their bank accounts and on their balance sheets, as a figure, but it's actually there's no way to verify whether that figure on the balance sheet actually means anything or not. So I would compare that to these secretive exploits of people like the Merchant Adventurers who were based in Bristol. And by the way, we were banned and abolished. So anyway, back up to more modern times. I'm quite well known for my research on this thing called the Bilderberg conferences. Many people will know and have heard of them, but they are essentially an American CIA-led a series of secret meetings between politicians, bankers, and what you would call the power elite in Europe. And the purpose of it is to weld Europe to the United States, and also to provide a secret place where hidden agendas can be pushed forward. But the main job after the Second World War, which is when this was set up, the first Bilderberg conference in Oosterbeek in Germany in a hotel owned by Prince Bernhard, who was the first chairman, the main purpose of it was to stop parts of Europe having any sympathy with communism and Soviet Russia, particularly the Italians, as many people know, had a large communist party and was drifting to the left, saying, well, we actually really want this kind of American-style way of doing things. We actually quite like the Russian style, so we're going to have a communist party. This is what the people of Italy wanted. But the CIA and the Bilderbergers and the P2 lodges in Italy did not want this at all. And so there was a covert campaign of intimidation, including the kidnapping of the former president Aldo Moro in the 1980s, in order to intimidate the Italians into thinking that they were actually under threat from the Soviet Union, where actually these operations were organised through NATO, SHAPE headquarters in Europe. And it's one of the most important things that's happened since the Second World War is this so-called Operation Gladio, where NATO intelligence, a covert planning team in Brussels, were actually organising terrorist attacks on ordinary citizens right across Europe. I'm not sure about here in Britain, but certainly in Ireland, some of the attacks during the Irish Troubles were in fact organised by MI6, NATO and the Central Intelligence Agency in order to discredit the IRA. The attacks in Dublin and Moynihan, some of the bloodiest killings, bloodiest bomb attacks during the Troubles were actually bombs supplied by the British Army. So this is a really important, if you've never heard of Operation Gladio, you really need to. There was a BBC Time Watch series done all about it, three programmes in 1992, and you can find those on the internet if you want to watch about it. But it is the most incredible, one of the most incredible documentaries you'll ever see. What you've got on there is mostly right-wing people and fascists talking honestly about how they were conned into blowing up ordinary civilians, and then the whole thing was then blamed on the left, whether it be the Red Brigades in Italy, the Baader-Meinhof, people like that in Germany, or it was Action Directe in Belgium, and the supermarket attacks, the Brabant massacres they're called, where special forces basically just turned up outside supermarkets, machine gunning people and police. When the police turned up, they machine gunned them too. And this was all blamed on the Russians. Actually, it was organised by NATO, SHAPE headquarters, covert planning team. So you can see what's happening here is that the European public, with NATO and the Bilderbergers, the NATO really being a military arm and the Bilderberg being a political arm of the same organisation, essentially scaring us, scaring the population into believing there was a big threat from the Soviet Union. Even during the Cuban Missile Crisis, as not very many people realise, although the Americans had gone up to their highest defence condition, this is in the early 1960s, they were ready for nuclear war. In fact, they even fired a test ballistic missile out towards Russia during the height of the Cuban Missile Crisis. The Russians didn't retaliate, but that ballistic missile actually was a test. It had a dummy warhead on it, and it was a test that was due to happen anyway. But this was Strategic Air Command trying to start World War III, because Strategic Air Command in the US saw that the Russians were building nuclear weapons at quite a pace, and if they didn't have a nuclear war soon, the Russians were going to overtake them. That was the disease thinking amongst the American high command, and thankfully JFK stopped their attempt to start the Third World War, and he paid the ultimate price. So there's been quite a lot going on since the Second World War is what I'm trying to say, and there's a very, very close relationship between NATO and the Bilderbergers, which I've looked into. If you're interested, the website is bilderberg.org, and you'll find a lot of the original source material, which I dug out in Oxford about 12 years ago, on the origins of the Bilderberg conferences. Prince Bernhard was the main figure who started these conferences. He was a former SS officer in the run-up to the Second World War. And this seems to be sort of almost lost on people. Well, the chairman of this conference from 1954 to 1975 is a former SS officer, an enthusiastic member of the SS in the run-up to World War II. Prince Bernhard then married into the Dutch royal family and went kind of neutral during the war. But you can see what's going on. It's like Royal Dutch Shell. They're hedging their bets. We don't care who wins the war. We're going to win both ways. Shell was half owned, half of the shares were in Britain, or half of the investment was in Britain, half was in Holland. So people weren't really sure which way it was going to go. And if whichever way, the people would still keep the company going. So that's Bernhard for you. He died 2 or 3 years ago, and he was kicked out in 1975. Older of us can remember something called the Lockheed scandal in 75, where Bernhard was caught taking a bribe of $1 million by a note he left, which was picked up by a chambermaid in his hotel, apparently, and handed to a journalist, which proved that he'd taken a bribe from Lockheed of $1 million in order to get the Dutch Royal Air Force to buy Starfighter jets from the Lockheed in America. And these Starfighter jets just happened to be hopeless jets that had tiny wings and kept falling out of the sky. But anyway, he'd taken a bribe of $1 million to get them to buy these rubbish planes. And so he was discredited, and he had to then leave the Bilderbergers to be taken over by others. The main financial power behind Bilderberg is the Rothschilds and the Rockefellers. I was lucky enough to meet David Rockefeller at one of these Bilderberg meetings in Versailles, strolling around the gardens of Versailles, and he came across as a very kindly old granddad. They're very clever, these people, at coming across as being really innocuous and friendly. But if you look at, and I was saying to him, why don't you let the press in? It's such a private meeting. Well, one of the things we've discovered since is that the state pays for all the security at these meetings. So it's not a private meeting, it's a public meeting. In which case it needs to be open to the public and to the press. As you may have seen over the last few years, it's been great to see people like Charlie Skelton at The Guardian, who was the script editor on the programme 10 o'clock live, which some of you may have seen on Channel 4 if you're into comedy on television, and doing a very good job, I think, of exposing the hypocrisy and the secrecy and the fascism, because that's what it is. Big money power telling government what to do, holding a gun to the heads of government saying, this is the policy, do it or die. That's essentially what these Bilderberg meetings are all about. And that what they do also is that they bring on our new party leaders. So they will, we spend our lives voting away every few years, every 4 or 5 years for a new government, but the Bilderbergers are choosing the heads of the parties. So what is the point in us voting while the Bilderbergers do this? They're taking the mickey. And at least it's not all in plain sight. One of the things I loved about Charlie Skelton's coverage at this year's Bilderberg meeting, the Bilderberg conference, was he came up with this phrase, because what happens is as soon as all the press people arrive, you're never quite sure if you're in the right place, right? Because it's only leaked where these conferences are going to be. They don't tell people. And so everyone turns up what they hope is the right place. And the morning, the first morning of the conference, that's the Thursday morning, everyone turns up at the hotel and there's this kind of wall, curtain around the hotel, so you can't get in. So you clearly, this is the right place. This is the Bilderbergers, they're meeting here. And he called it this curtain looks like a shower curtain. It was a kind of beigey colour thing, right the way around the hotel. And he called it the shower curtain of shame. The shower curtain of shame. And they having to put this, it's almost like they're naked behind this curtain now. There's more and more people understand that this conference exists, that this is a kind of secret government for NATO and the West, where the real decisions are made, and it's decided who is going to be on side, who is not going to be on side. John Smith, if anyone remembers him, the Labour leader back in the early 90s, he went to a Bilderberg conference, he was not on side. By the next time of the next conference, John Smith had died, had a heart attack in the Barbican in London, in his flat. And Tony Blair was the new Labour leader. Tony Blair went along to the Bilderberg meeting in 1992, I think it was. No, maybe 93. And was embracing these Bilderbergers. Within a couple of years, within 4 years or so, he was Prime Minister. These are the kingmakers. And I think the way they operate smacks to me of a kind of secret government behind the scenes that we really do have to eradicate if we want any kind of future for our kids. Finally, I would say, I mentioned earlier on the Bullingdon Club. David Cameron, George Osborne, Michael Gove, Boris Johnson, Mark Thatcher, Nathan Rothschild, for example. These are the people that go to this club. And I'm really concerned that what we've got right now with Cameron and Osborne and others from this club in the cabinet, these millionaires, is we've got a cult running the country. Now, it may be that that's happened in the past, but I don't think Gordon Brown was a cult leader or a member of a cult. He certainly used to talk about a new world order, but he was his own man. He certainly had Alistair Darling, who's quite an independent-minded... I don't know if anyone saw Alistair Darling on any of these programmes like Newsnight, where he used to appear occasionally, but he was extremely good at putting down people like Paxman and putting them in their place. Whereas we wouldn't have that kind of behaviour from these Bullingdon Club people, because they know they have to be friendly with the TV people. It's all one, actually. And one of the big problems that we're facing now is our media, quite clearly, the big media in this country is not telling people what they need to hear in order to make decisions to run their lives. I would suggest that now we've moved out of the world of the Army and the Navy and the Air Force. We're talking about cyber warfare, that is to say, stealing things like passwords from your computers, that kind of thing, identifying searches, Google and Facebook and LinkedIn. These internet services were all at this latest Bilderberg conference. And Amazon, by the way, were also at the latest Bilderberg conference with the head of the Pentagon Cyber Warfare Department, the latest conference we had. There's also space war, of course, satellites knocking each other's satellites out. That's quite clearly on the agenda for the future. And this whole thing of the missile defence shield, which is what NATO are rolling out right across Europe, is in fact an attack on the Soviet Union. Sorry, well, it isn't the Soviet Union anymore. It's an attack on Russia. So that's a really important thing to understand. It's called a missile defence shield. It's actually, the idea is that if we attack the Russians, or possibly Chinese, that they won't be able to retaliate. That's the whole point of the missile defence shield, and this is why it's causing so much problem. I would have thought it was obvious to most people that this is a massive step up in the arms race. Why are we doing this? What's the point in taking the arms race a whole another 3 or 4 decades forward? We should be disarming. Why do we want to fight these people when we've got nuclear weapons around all over the world now? Do we want to start a fight? I look at Libya and I think sometimes maybe NATO does want to start a fight, a bit like the Strategic Air Command tried to start a fight during the Cuban Missile Crisis by lying to Kennedy and saying that there were no nuclear weapons in Cuba when they knew there were, and they knew that if Kennedy decided to invade Cuba, that there would be a nuclear war. So, what have we got in the way of, oh, of course, media war, right. You look at Miss Rupert Murdoch over the last couple of weeks and all this business, and we can talk about this afterwards, but I'll say just for my view of all this is that at last, I mean, Murdoch took over the Times in 1981. The BBC was neutered so that Murdoch could then get his way. In 1986, when the last decent director general who was actually a programme maker, a current affairs programme maker, not like me, but I do make current affairs programmes, I produce current affairs programmes and present them. But these are the types of people we need running the BBC. People like Alistair Milne, and he was nobbled by Victor Rothschild in 1986, who said to Marmaduke Hussey, who was the chairman of the Board of Governors, and Hussey says this in his autobiography, can you sack the Director General? This is Victor Rothschild asks Marmaduke Hussey, chairman of the Board of Governors, can you sack the Director General? Now, it's not Victor Rothschild's job to decide who does and who does not run the BBC. And we've been suffering with a denuded BBC ever since. It doesn't actually stand up to government properly anymore as it used to. One of the programmes it made just before we finished, the BBC was nobbled in 1986, was something called Maggie's Militant Tendency. This was a panorama programme looking at the far right in the Conservative Party. If you may remember, it was at a time where all of the newspapers were having a go at Labour militant all over the place. Militant was this organisation, part of the left, which was extremely dangerous, and yet the militant tendency within the Conservative Party, the far right, what you might even call neo-Nazi side of the Conservative Party, was being ignored. Panorama aired this documentary, and within about 3 months, the Director General had been sacked by Victor Rothschild, Margaret Thatcher, and by Marmaduke Hussey. So we don't have a free press anymore once that kind of thing happens. The BBC is far too important to be run by an accountant. Michael Checkland, who took over as Director General after that, was the BBC's accountant. Do you want a programme maker running the organisation, or do you want an accountant running it? So today, what have we got? Well, we've got these two international satellite channels, Press TV and Russia Today, both of which, certainly through my dealings, they seem to be open to suggestions for programmes. I mean, if I phone up one of their editors and say, we've got an idea for a programme, blah, 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 about doing this, they're actually listening, and they may do something. If you phone the BBC, what they do, do you know what they do? They steal your idea, and then they get someone like Alan Titchmarsh to front it. Did anyone see the interview with Duke of Edinburgh, with Alan Titchmarsh? What a joke. What a joke. This is insulting, right? And I would suggest that sort of thing should make you not want to pay your licence fee. But Having said that, the BBC also do some very, very good programmes too, particularly on BBC Four. So, you know, it's a bit of a dilemma. It's all we've got, the BBC, really. I mean, obviously, we have other newspapers like The Guardian. We have the Daily Mail doing some good stuff as well. None of it's perfect. What we need is a broad range of media. And still, at least, we have a bit of a broad range of media, even if it is very, very scared. The big, powerful mafia dons, like Rupert Murdoch, know how to threaten people. Anybody that they know has got any information on them, and they've got their own intelligence gathering network, like a state intelligence network, they will put the pressure on. Anybody with a big audience, like Paxman, someone like that, if they get hold of something which might be damaging to the capo, the head of the mafia in the Western world, Rupert Murdoch, then that person will be threatened. As we saw last week, somebody who had hard evidence, absolute personal testimony to make against Andy Coulson, who was the director of communications for David Cameron, he found himself dead in the morning. This is Sean Hoare I'm talking about, who is one of only two people alive today who've actually properly testified against Andy Coulson and explained that Coulson himself was personally behind all this hideous phone hacking. I mean, it really is horrendous. I mean, you don't need to be a genius to work out why this has caused such a big fuss in this country, that you are hacking into the mobile phones of 7-7 victims, 7-7 victims' families and loved ones, hacking into the phones of soldiers who've been killed in Afghanistan, Iraq, or anywhere else. And the whole thing which kicked this latest round of this off, which is the Millie Dowler story, where phone messages were actually being deleted to her phone to make room for more messages which might give the News of the World another line and another story. This is absolutely horrendous criminal activity, and it scares me to think that the police didn't act at the time. Let's just hope that Operation Weeting, which is going on now, actually arrests these people and puts them behind bars for a very long time, because they are absolutely destructive to this country and to everything we hold dear, and to anyone that's trying to do any good in this country is going to be a victim of this Murdoch mafia. So they have to go. They just have to go. Amongst other good things going on out there, from time to time, you see Al Jazeera, maybe, but there are Wahhabis from Qatar, which are rather dodgy. That's like a cult in itself within Islam. There are some other good things on YouTube, a lot of interesting bits and pieces, including something called the Prophecy Club. I don't know if anyone's ever come across that. It's an American series of speeches, talks a bit like this, which is looking into specific interesting issues, one, you know, usually on one specific topic. Okay, assassination. Princess Diana certainly looks like an assassination. If you read John Morgan's book, which has come out recently about that, the inquest is a total sham. She was killed, it looks almost certain, because of her landmines campaign. That was the final thing, which was the straw that broke the camel's back with that one. There were a lot of people in the royalty and in the British establishment that didn't like Diana, but the fact that she was supporting this anti-landmines campaign united the French landmine manufacturers and the British to do her in. David Kelly, quite clearly, obviously now, there's also a very good book on the subject, The Strange Death of David Kelly by Norman Baker, who's now in the government. He was quite clearly suicided. Quite who by is, it doesn't really matter, but this was all to make the case for this criminal invasion of Iraq. Robin Cook, potentially, the guy that fell off a mountain, who was on the Today programme quite often, ripping these American spokespeople to shreds, and a man of great integrity, actually, who resigned when it came to the decision to go to war with Iraq, even though he is foreign secretary. And his speech at the House of Commons shows he was a man of integrity. He could not go. He could not sanction this decision to go to war. And the interesting thing about Robin is that once Blair went, he would be almost a shoe-in to be Labour leader. So if anyone that tells you that politics isn't important, just remind them about Robin Cook. Someone else assassinated, which is much better known, is Mahmoud Aboud. Now, he was killed, this guy who was killed January last year, if you remember, in Dubai by Mossad. A team of 11 assassins dressed in tennis outfits and various other things. People remember this? This was quite big in the news for 3 or 4 days and a couple of months, on and off. Wearing tennis outfits, get into his room, inject him with a drug. And he was actually the elected security chief for one of the Palestinian factions. And the whole thing was recorded on CCTV camera in the hotel as this 11-man and woman crew came in to assassinate this guy. And there apparently were also 15 people behind the scenes in various countries and in Dubai supporting the assassination team. So this is how these things clearly, you know, this kind of thing works. And certainly the Mossad have been up to it, because when the police chief in Dubai talked about the Mossad being behind this, he himself got two death threats because from the Mossad, because he had actually discovered who'd done it and he was publicising it around the world. And this is what happened was, if you remember, they were using British passports, a lot of these people. And what happened? One Israeli diplomat was expelled and nothing really more has been heard of it. So it seems that we're not really dealing. I mean, the Israelis are supposed to be our allies, supposedly, and yet they're using British passports to go around the world assassinating people. And the reason that they give is because, oh, well, the Israeli passport, people are suspicious of it, so we wanted to use a British passport. And what is our Foreign Office doing if they're letting them get away with that kind of thing? Absolutely outrageous. Someone a bit more recently that died in mysterious circumstances is Christopher Shale. Christopher Shale was David Cameron's constituency party chairman in Oxfordshire, in Witney. So he's the guy who's in charge of the local party that Cameron's a member of, and Cameron has been decided as the MP candidate. Christopher Shale wrote a great scathing criticism of the Conservative Party, which came out in the papers on the Friday. And if you remember, his body was found in a toilet in the Glastonbury Festival on the Sunday morning. This is someone who had was criticising Cameron's leadership style, and was also in a position to decide whether David Cameron was going to actually stand as the Conservative candidate for Witney in the next election. So very, very strange. And Michael Shrimpton, who I interviewed about on this very subject, he's a QC over in, he's a member of the Royal United Services Institute, and I don't know if he's actually an ex-serviceman. But anyhow, he was saying that this is actually a rogue unit called GO2 within MI6, which is the Foreign Intelligence Service. Two teams of people apparently went to assassinate Christopher Shale. So we're living in a country where we have, at least, there's a strong possibility we've got death squads running around. Look at David Kelly. That was a death squad. I don't think there's any doubt about that, Kelly being murdered. I mean, does anyone here doubt whether David Kelly was murdered? Did he really try and kill himself in a way which is actually impossible, according to all the expert opinion? You can't kill yourself by just slitting your wrist. It doesn't work. So, and then 1 week ago, the murder of Sean Hoare, or the death, the strange death of Sean Hoare, in this phone hacking scandal, the one man who can bring down the Prime Minister. He can stand there in a court of law and explain how the guy that our Prime Minister decided to hire as his Director of Communications is one of the biggest criminal masterminds in the country. So what does it tell us about the state of our democracy? Well, you know, David Cameron certainly hasn't swept away the corruption, you know. He's actually brought it to a whole new and much higher level. And it's really rather frightening, because there is evidence, if you go to a blog by Peter Eyre, E-Y-R-E, who's a former NATO intelligence guy, he explains how in 1992, David Cameron went on a trip to South Africa, because in South Africa, was just going over to majority rule, black rule in South Africa, and the whites had created 10 nuclear bombs they didn't want the blacks to have. And David Cameron allegedly took 3 of these nuclear weapons and sold them on the black market to raise money for the Tory party. Now, you may think that's crazy, Tony. And I thought that's crazy, Tony. But you check out Peter Eyre's blog, E-Y-R-E, and you will see that he's got all thing, chapter and verse. This is... Looks like these people are insiders that knew about this stuff at the time. So my own opinion is that Cameron isn't necessarily going to last the course. He's got too many skeletons in his closet. He's hired one of the biggest criminal masterminds in the country that the army hate. And you get the armed forces hating Mr. Coulson for hacking into their dead soldiers' phones and their families' phones. How long is Mr. Cameron going to last? And I must admit, when he first hired Coulson, because a lot of us journalists knew about this phone hacking story way back then, my immediate thought was, this Mr. Coulson is a ticking time bomb under David Cameron. How long is Cameron going to last? But the final thing I'll say, actually no, because we'll talk a bit about Norway before I finish, is that this is actually serves certain people's interests to have a destabilised country. To have a chaotic government, to have a destabilised country, a lot of people can make a lot of money out of that. Talk about, for example, the electricity companies. When there's a weak, chaotic government, electricity companies just rack the prices up and no one can do anything about it. Look at what Cameron's done with the armed forces, with the police. We just heard last week, is it 35,000 police are going to go? That just creates more chaos. This is all great for the mafia. They love it. Organised crime loves a chaotic, weak government because they make a fortune out of it. And one thing I would say is about the phone hacking, before we just leave that story for a minute, is this book here, The Untouchables. This is produced by Michael Gillard and Laurie Flynn back in 2004, which is all about, it says, dirty cops, bent justice and racism in Scotland Yard. Now, the Untouchables are, guess who? Let's open and have a look. Who are the Untouchables? Well, Duncan McLaughlin, who was head of the drug squad, he was one of the top people in the drug squad, in his book, The Filth, says that the drug squad at Scotland Yard was the best organised criminal gang in the country. The Untouchables, as we go down here. Andy Heyman. He was in the House of Commons being interrogated the other week. Who else here? John Yates, who resigned the other day. But there's a whole list of them in here, the cast of characters. This book was due to go in The Guardian serialised, and the lawyers said, no, we can't do it. That was about 2004. So this story's been brewing under the surface for a long, long time. The close connections between Murdoch, Empire and Scotland Yard are crucial, because everybody that works in Scotland Yard knows you can't cross Murdoch, otherwise you're going to be out. One reason or another, there's going to be something printed in the paper about you. The other thing is, there's no need to be annoyed with Murdoch, because how many of the former News of the World and News International people are there in the press office at Scotland Yard? Something like 12. Some people say even 20 of the press officers, almost all the press officers at one point or another in Scotland Yard, have been one-time employees of News International. So we've got a criminal gang at the heart of our criminal justice system. And really a subversion of the rule of law. These people are not interested in the rule of law. The mafia has been slowly strangling. So this phone hacking story is at the heart of a lot of things. Let's just finish on Norway, because that's what's in most people's minds at the moment. This is The Sun from Saturday. Al-Qaeda massacre. Now, they'd had 10 hours before their print deadline to figure out what was going on, but they decided it was an Al-Qaeda massacre. It was Norway's 9/11. Page 5, the Sun's chief investigative reporter, which of course is a Rupert Murdoch rag. Norway has long feared... This is Simon Hughes, chief investigative reporter of The Sun. Norway has long feared an attack by Muslim hardliners. The country has troops fighting in Afghanistan. Fanatics were infuriated when a Norwegian newspaper reprinted notorious Danish cartoons depicting the Prophet Muhammad in 2006. Well, I don't know what this guy is, how this guy got the job as chief investigative reporter, but he's talking total rubbish and lies and racism. So this is one of the key stories of our times, I think, the whole phone hacking business, and it's got a long way to go. I would suggest, before I wrap up, the direction it's going in is... Most importantly is to do with the whole vetting process. The way that this country vets people who work in government. Now, Andy Coulson, this criminal mastermind, how did he get a vetting? Well, the answer is he didn't. He only got a very, very low level of vetting. And which company vetted him even to that low level? Well, Cameron in the House of Commons was slightly wrong-footed by that question, and he said, I can't tell you, it's covered by national security. So this is a very weak spot. And I'll go back to the 7/7 London bombings, because the company that took over the London Underground security system, CCTV system, just before the 7/7 London bombings, was run by a former Israeli officer in the Israeli army who was in the Israeli Corps of Engineers, an explosives expert. Actually, Daniel Bodner ran Verint Systems, which is an Israeli company, which is still to this day, and since just before the London bombings, running the whole CCTV security system on the London Underground. It's unbelievable, but how on earth does a company like that get vetted? So vetting is one serious question that the population of this country, and particularly the travelling public of London, deserve an answer to. So anyway, I'll finish there, and it would be nice to have any questions if you'd like to... And somebody might like at some point to go into the fact that this guy Anders Breivik in Norway was a Freemason.
If we can use the mic so that everyone else can hear you, because there's quite a few people here.
Why do you think that Germany has retained its industrial base and all our industries have been virtually destroyed?
Well, it's a good question, isn't it? I mean, this country's industrial heartland has been ripped out. I mean, we're not in charge anymore. I think it's pretty clear to see. You know, the British London was in charge of many affairs around the world for many years, but we're not in charge anymore. We're not most favoured nation status. I mean, we have this thing in Bristol where we have an airfield called Filton, which is one of the it's a big airfield where a lot of the development of aviation took place, and there's companies like Rolls-Royce, Airbus based here, yet they're going to close the airfield because British Aerospace don't need the airfield, and they've decided they want to close it and put it out for housing. Basically, it's rip off Britain, and everything is up for sale. Anyone that can make a few bob will do it. They certainly don't care about us anymore. And even, you know, if you talk to the miners, for example, you're talking about industry, many miners will say it's great we don't have to go down the pits anymore. But what are these communities now going to do? A lot of the South Wales mining communities are turning over to all sorts of weird stuff like alcohol, drugs, and they haven't really got a reason to be. We certainly need a vision for the future, and that needs to be a post-industrial vision, I think. I don't think we are going to be an industrial nation into the future. When you hear politicians talking about, oh, we need to get into high tech, you know what that mostly means? It mostly means things like missiles and armaments and bombs, because this is the way NATO wants us to go in the future. It's a very Orwellian world of war, the war industry, the warfare state, with a state which is geared around just production for war. And this is one of the reasons I think that they're in Libya, where they seem to manage to create these wars which last forever. Do you remember the war in South Ossetia and Georgia? Do you remember that a few years ago with the Russians? And the Georgians, was it Georgia? I can't actually remember. Where the shots were fired during the opening ceremony to the Chinese Olympics. So all the world's media is focused on China, but then there's this little war starts. Now, the Russians decide to act, and I'm no great fan of Putin. I mean, he's probably a pretty ruthless guy in his own way. But that war lasted for 4 days. After 4 days, the Russian troops stopped where they were. They'd retaken that bit of territory and there was no more killing going on. With our wars, they're a completely different character. What's happening is, in Afghanistan and Iraq, places like that, there's now constant bomb attacks, ordinary civilians being killed, and these wars are lasting forever. There's only one faction in this world that really benefits, and that's the arms industry, the privatised arms industry. And those are the people, it seems, now in NATO and in Europe are calling the shots. But this is one of the reasons I like talking about land, is because I think the future is actually much more rural than we'd have it believe. Our cities can only be sustained if we have a good industrial base in those cities to sustain those people. Without the industrial base, what's the point in people all living in the same place? Our cities will have to get smaller and people will have to go more back to the land. And we have to see some of these big estates broken up. I don't think there's any choice in this, I really don't. It's going to happen at some point in the future. It's just a question of what is the actual necessity which will bring it about.
Uh,
Two questions. First question, there was no usury in Anglo-Saxon England, where apparently there was usury after the Norman Conquest. On the other hand, Christians were not allowed to be involved in usury, so how did usury come about? That's the first question. And the second question is, what were the policies of Maggie's militant tendency?
Well, okay, start the second one first. That's pretty easy. People like Neil Hamilton were, as part of the National Front, were very, not just anti-immigration, but really had a whole racist ideology that went along with it. And that was what the Panorama people were filming, doing secret filming of their private views. I mean, this is one of the things that goes with the far right, is that there is a genuine and absolutely correct question about immigration and whether that's good for the country. And that whole problem is being subsumed by these more far-right groups who have another agenda, which is a racist agenda. So I don't think most people have any problem with anybody who's in some part of the world which is being bombed coming here for shelter, particularly when it's us that's bombing them, which is most of the time it is. But the whole far-right BNP thing is the people actually running the BNP, I believe, and I've seen, you know, I've seen, for example, this filming that the Panorama did, it was quite clear that there was a racist agenda behind it. A little bit like this guy Breivik over in Norway was a racist. He was really bothered that people from other parts of the world might come and stay in his country. But I think you've got to separate the two between a genuine and absolutely correct problem with masses of economic migrants, undercutting wages and this kind of thing, and a racist agenda. Because what happens is that these people are organising political parties to really scoop up that sentiment. But where are they really coming from? Are they really patriotic? Or are the leaders of these groups, I'm not talking about the supporters, it's like the church, you know. You're not necessarily a Freemason if you're in the congregation, but you may be at the top of the church. You may be as a canon or as a bishop or whatever. So what was your first question again? Sorry, you were talking about usury, wasn't it? Well, I mean, it's just one of those things. Well, as I said, the Jewish attitude was that we won't charge interest to other Jews, but we will to Gentiles. So that's where, essentially, one of the places where it came from. And anybody who's wealthy will try and make more money from that wealth, unless they're stopped from doing so by the law. Now, that was the way up until the Normans. The Normans relaxed those laws so that people could lend at interest.
Just two questions. About the BBC, does the BBC own all the other channels, the ITV and that? And also, number two, where does all the money go from the TV licences as far as we know?
Well, okay. The BBC, no, it doesn't, no. I mean, it's a slightly separate system. The BBC is its own system, even though slowly parts of the BBC have been being privatised. For example, the transmitters were privatised. Other parts of it, like sort of technical support services, things like that. If you want to apply for a job at the BBC, that's all privatised. Yeah, so the BBC don't do that themselves. Siemens, which is was a Nazified company in the Second World War, for example, now owns and operates all the transmitters that the BBC use, which is a little bit concerning. Also, Lord Reith, that created the BBC back in the 30s, whenever it was, late 20s, early 30s, also had some quite right-wing fascistic tendencies. He wasn't exactly a perfect guy. But generally speaking, the BBC are quite liberal, and the money, where does it go? Well, mostly it goes on staff. And as a member of the National Union of Journalists, I work quite often with other journalists who are members of our union in the BBC, and you may have seen recently there was a strike about redundancies. Now, I don't know whether you think that's right or wrong, but the reason that they're striking is very political, very politically charged, because what's happening is they're trying to get rid of staff at the BBC, largely because of the lobbying of Rupert Murdoch, of course, if you knew that. But this is a deal done pre-election with Murdoch to neuter the BBC, to cut the BBC down, which is Murdoch sees as unfair competition. And as part of that, these cuts, what's happened is the staff have gone to the BBC and said, right, you want a cut? We've got a whole bunch of people who want to take voluntary redundancy. And actually, we've got enough people who will take voluntary redundancy. But the BBC have said, no, we don't want to do that. We want to decide who's going to be made redundant. Now, that is a very political decision, because they can then sack individual members of staff for their views. If they don't like what a report that someone's done on Newsnight, next week you're out. So that's why the union, the National Union of Journalists, is actually quite an important union in the background in Britain. And we are very, very strong at the BBC. Almost all the journalists at the BBC are in the union and understand that actually when they're talking about compulsory redundancies, what they really mean is we want to stop the journalists having an independent mind.
Just a follow-on question about your television career.
I haven't had a television career apart from a little bit, and it's mostly almost been radio.
Yeah, and local radio. A previous speaker said that within the BBC studios there was a unit of MI5 who monitored what was about to go out.
Yeah.
And if they didn't like it, then they would put a stop to it.
Yeah, that's right. It's called The Christmas Tree Files, and this was a book on vetting, which was written by Richard Norton Taylor, who's a security correspondent now on The Guardian. And it was called The Christmas Tree Files. MI5 had an office next to the personnel department at the BBC. This is back in the 1980s, this book was written.
Can I just have a follow-on? Because I was shocked when you mentioned David Cameron had gone to South Africa and sold 3 nuclear bombs. Who'd he sell them to?
Well, apparently on the black market, and one of them appeared in North Korea about two, three years ago. North Koreans blew one of these bombs up. Now, apparently, if I can just go into that story a bit more, apparently he raised about £15 million for the Tory party by doing this sale. But although he got the money, he lost the bombs. So those bombs went out. You really have to go to Peter Eyre's blog to check this story out, or the Palestine Telegraph. Peter, E-Y-R-E, and he's a former intelligence officer himself, but he writes some of the most fascinating stuff. He's also done a very good blog on the Chinook crash at Mullochintyre 5-6 years ago, where it looks like some top intelligence people were assassinated in this RAF Chinook because the computer system was overridden from another helicopter which was flying nearby. And they tried to make it look like an accident. So Peter Eyre is very good on all that stuff. I mean, this is one of the things I try and do, is to point out that there are actually some brilliant sources out there, really interesting. The thing you can normally, I mean, I would say there's two websites I use quite a lot. One is globalresearch.ca, which is Michel Chosudovsky at Quebec University. If you want to just, you know, you want to just, you're on the internet, you think, well, what's actually really going on? Global Research is a brilliant place to start, because you'll find independent reports on all sorts of big things that are going on, like the Libya campaign, things like the Missile Defence Shield, the Bilderberg conferences. A lot of these important events, he has a digest of some of the best reports from around the English-speaking media, including things like the Asia Times, Australian papers, and also he has specialist writers writing for it. And he's based at the University, Montreal, in the summit called the Centre for Research on Globalisation. And Michel Chosudovsky is one of the best web editors in the world. So you'll see they're basically a newspaper style tab, broadsheet style articles on everything that's going on in the world. The other one I like a lot is called whatreallyhappened.com, which is a digest of English language stuff from all around the world. And you know, you'll see all sorts of crazy stuff on there, but it's up to you to decide whether you think it's true or not.
I haven't been long in this the New Horizons, but it's fascinating stuff. First of all, about 3 questions. One of the speakers on 7-7, the chap who came here, he actually asked to talk to him after the conference and after the night, and he said that Mossad is really running everything. Now, whether or not that's true or not.
Well, look, I'll stop you right there, because no one's running everything. Yeah? Nobody is running everything. And this is one of the things that frustrates me, which, oh, it's all in control. No one's in. It's actually not like that. There's all sorts of fighting going on, yeah, ideological fighting, particularly within the media, within the military. So you've got ideologies in the military trying to take over, like the pro-NATO people versus the anti-NATO people in the British military. You've got loads of these conflicts. It's certainly not anybody in control. And this is what's the problem with this kind of Illuminati-style controlling the top and the hope that it's going to control the rest, is actually a lot of the rest is of a different mind and doesn't want to be told what to do. And I think that's actually a trait here in Britain, is we're quite depoliticised. We don't like necessarily to be involved in politics, but we do know when we don't trust somebody like the bank manager or the boss. And we don't actually go along with things. So did you have another question? No. All right, one at a time. Okay, over there.
The Illuminati, does not the Illuminati consist of 13 families?
I'm not an expert on the Illuminati.
Each of those 13 families has a representative on what is called the Council of Druids. And at the top of the Council of Druids is probably a man that they call Pindar.
Okay, I think it's always important to underpin this stuff with evidence and references. Yeah? Really important. The Illuminati stuff I've talked about is all about the original furore that was created back in the 1700s. And you can read that stuff on sacredtext.com. It's all there. It's all documented. This is something that's been kind of forgotten about for hundreds of years, but actually it's still all there if you want to read it. I'd also point out that John Robison, who wrote this book, Proofs of a Conspiracy, was the inventor of the siren. You know, the thing that was wailing out across the cities in World War II as an air raid. So he invented the siren. So he should know about warning people.
It's something that David Icke is one person who's mentioned that, and there's other people, there's a guy in America called Dr. Bill Deagle.
It doesn't matter who's mentioned it, you've got to have it referenced. You've got to have it underpinned with facts, references. All that is crucial. Otherwise, it's unusable. It's just rumour. This is why, when I'm talking about Cameron being a nuclear arms dealer before he became Prime Minister, is you have to look at the blog, you have to look at the references, and you'll see that a lot of this stuff does check out if you check through the references, which is what, as journalists, we all should do, which was what the chief reporter of The Sun never bothers to do. Because he's already decided what you should know. I mean, this is the thing I think with the press, is there's two sides to it. The press should either reflect public opinion and public concerns, or direct it. Murdoch is clearly out to direct what we think. He's going to tell us what to think. He's not interested in what our concerns are.
Tony, I think you've done a fantastic job tonight, mate. Proper journalism, that.
Well, we can't actually finish yet, because we've got to say a little bit about Norway, because I was hoping that was going to be a question about Norway. Anders Breivik, this guy, well, he's straight out of the Knights Templar. He actually is a Knights Templar, and he's a Freemason. And it's very strange to see that just on Friday that something like this should happen. Obviously a horrendous act, not necessarily certain that he acted alone, but there are some peculiar facts to do with it all. As I was just, with my journalistic eye and my suspicious mind, looking at the stuff that's been coming out about it all. First of all, the police have gone on the record in Norway saying, we have never arrested this man, we have never come across him before. Exactly the same as what our police said at 7-7. These guys are all clean skins, we've never seen them before, and of course it's come out afterwards that they had been following MI5 and the anti-terrorist police had been following some of these 7-7 bombers years beforehand. So that was a lie. So I would say not necessarily that the police in Norway are lying, but certainly the Norwegian Secret Service will have been following neo-Nazis. No doubt about it. That's one of the target groups for the Secret Services. But then the Secret Service didn't come on the TV and tell us we didn't know anything about him, did they? The police did. So the other suspicious thing to do with all this was, after an hour and a half of going around killing people, Anders Breivik was approached by the Norwegian police, who'd got onto the island finally, and they called out his name and he dropped the gun. How did they know his name? How did they know his name? Because normally police work, what happens is you arrest someone and then you establish their identity, don't you? How do they know his name? Also the fact that he's a Freemason and he says a Christian, well, this form of Christianity is a little bit of a strange one to me, because I don't ever remember in the book of Matthew seeing Jesus going around with a machine gun killing nearly 100 people who'd never done anything wrong. I don't think that's not the Jesus I ever read about. And I think this is the same sort of brand of Christianity which Bush and Blair adhere to. And the only thing being that Bush and Blair are criminals who are responsible for the deaths of millions of people, not just 80 or so. And the common thread, it appears, is Freemasonry. Because within Freemasonry, there is this kind of really twisted view of what these main religions are like. Judaism, Islam, because there are some Muslims in Freemasonry, and Christianity. There's a totally twisted view, and that is, basically, we don't bother reading the Bible, because Freemasonry is a deistic faith. That means you believe in God, but you don't ever bother with the Bible. So what happens is you start thinking you're God. And I think this is the kind of thinking that was in the head of Anders Breivik when he was going around murdering all those innocent people, assassinating all the political future of... And this was the summer camp for the ruling left-wing party in Norway, which is a very liberal-minded and actually quite tolerant party in Norway. And Norway is one of the most successful countries. It's kept out of the EU. Yeah? It's just about to pull its troops out of Libya. And they have something called a sovereign wealth fund, so they're not frightened of the IMF. They have used their North Sea oil revenues to build up a massive sovereign wealth fund in Norway to keep the future of the country stable financially. They're a very sensible bunch, the Norwegians. And, you know, this is clearly an attack by this Freemason. If I was the police over in Norway, I would be looking at all of his contacts, because the Masonic Lodge is something like a terrorist cell. It's a secret cult organisation where everyone is sworn to secrecy. So if I was the Norwegian police, I would be untangling exactly who was in his Masonic lodges, which Masonic lodges he was in, and who was meeting who at which points and which times. And I imagine that the most sensible Norwegian police are doing that right now and arresting other people who were in his lodge with Anders Breivik. It looks like some kind of Teutonic knight from Viking times almost, you know. Certainly the ideology he had was very racist and dangerous. The mindset of people like Anders Breivik is really a neo-Nazi mindset, which is actually anti-God and totally pro the self as God. I am God. That arrogance. And they see the rest of us as scum, as that goes with this God mentality. The rest of the people out there who don't understand all this esoteric knowledge, they are scum. They are the profane. And I just think that it's really crucial that the whole of the European world now and the anti-terrorist people, anyone serious involved in anti-terrorism across the Western world and the military, are aware that we have this cult mentality within Freemasonry and within the centre of our government. And I hope over the next year or so we'll see some action on that front. So thank you very much. If that's a finish.
Thank you very much, Tony. Exceptional, that, mate. Exceptional. Thank you very much.